This is James Gillen with As You Wish Talk Radio. We've got another great show. There's so many things happening on the platter right now, but I'm going to skip them because I really want to get to the information with Jason Martell. And, you know, he's a filmmaker. He's been researching Planet X, Anunnaki, Mars. I can go on and on with the latest work about ancient cities, but I really want to bring him on the show because I don't want to miss, you know, the information that, we can cover. So, Jason, are you with us?
I sure am, James. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, there are so many things going on right now. I know you've got your fingers in all kinds of pies like we all do right now. But, you know, that it's kind of like, where do you start? But I guess your latest adventure concerns, Dwarka and the ancient city off the coast of India.
Yes, that's correct, James. Essentially, what's going on is my partner Amish Shah has put together a documentary where he uncovered some strange activity happening in India. Not sure if we want to call it a cover-up just yet, but essentially he went to this city in India called Dwarka, which potentially has two Manhattan-sized cities right off the coast of India that are underwater. So these are potential cities that could be, oh, let's say 10,000 plus years old. We obviously don't know yet. But the documentary focuses on the fact that there were academic excavations of Dwarka, and then they stopped. And, you know, Dwarka is a very interesting city from India's past because it claims to have been the actual location of Lord Krishna, which is a, mm-hmm. a famous or infamous Hindu god. So the documentary, James, is, you know, putting it into a larger perspective of megalithic sites over the world and really focusing on just this one area, specifically Dwarka, where for whatever reason there seems to be some type of a cover-up around the lost cities that are still there off the coast of India.
Yeah, I know they've completely shut that down. I guess you can't go out there. They don't want anybody going out there or diving in those areas. I'm wondering who would be behind the shutdown. You know, there's so many different factions that would be, you know, upset by this because it totally, we have to rewrite history if this is true. And then on top of that, we, you know, Christian factions, other factions, you know, would find out that maybe the Bible, you know, it doesn't have everything in it, you know, that it should, and we might be a lot older.
I think so. And that's kind of what Amish ran into was when he went to India, he talked with, you know, several different people that were on these excavations, or tried to talk to them, and pursued some academic resources. And pretty much what he found is, you know, there were a few people willing to come on camera and discuss this, but what it seems to be is that there's a controversy at a political level, meaning there is something out there. There have been artifacts and things found that just push the envelope of our origins. And since the India politics, the academic and maybe some religious, are not able to come to a conclusion, they simply avoid it. And, you know, sticking your head in the sand like the ostrich syndrome doesn't usually help the situation very much. So what's really great about what we're doing here at Dwarka is, you know, with my partner Amish, who is the gentleman who traveled to India, he and I have formed a partnership where we're going to be exploring these locations and taking people along with us. The site is called ancientexplorers.com. Ancient Explorers, and Dwarka is our first public, you know, stepping foot forward where we're going to, again, investigate these locations that kind of do affect our mainstream views of history, but they need to be challenged by, you know, being there firsthand and collecting the evidence mm-hmm. for ourselves.
Yeah, I understand that there's an ancient temple there that they've been excavating, and they've gone down three levels, and there's, I guess, three different temples built on top of each other. And I guess they're going back well over, 9,000 years, somewhere around there now for these ancient
wow.
Cities with advanced cultures there.
Yeah, and that's kind of a pattern that we're seeing, James, from a larger perspective, and why Dvarka fits into this realm is, as you mentioned in the intro, thank you, I have been looking into these topics, whether it be through the History Channel show Ancient Aliens or just in my own personal research. I've been looking into ancient megalithic sites for many years, and that's really what I think sparked my original interest in these topics, was kind of trying to figure out where do we come from. And one of the overriding patterns that has really hooked my interest in the last few years is why we built the culture or civilizations over time, why we built such huge monuments, pyramids, Stonehenge, just various structures that all have astronomical references. And the conclusion, James, which I think we can kind of curtail the conversation for today, is, in my opinion, there seems to be a lost civilization that affected all the great ancient cultures we know of today. I'll kind of explain it. People have heard of, like, Atlantis, right, that there was some advanced civilization off the recorded history books, but, you know, they sunk into the ocean and they're gone. What I'm seeing is evidence for a lost, technologically advanced civilization, but it's a worldwide phenomenon. We have monuments on every continent around the Earth that we can't explain how they were built. And again, there's these astronomical references tied to each location. So in my opinion, James, what we're seeing is all the ancient cultures, like the Mayans and the Egyptians and Sumerians, they were all affected by some advanced lost culture that we're seeking today. And we're just starting to find pieces of their civilization in remote areas like Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, or at the Rapa Nui, the Easter Island in Rapa Nui there in the middle of the ocean. Over and over, we're seeing these types of figurines, these tall, slender beings being depicted at these locations. And in my opinion, James, I think these are depictions and remnants of a lost ancient culture that seem to have affected all the ancients that we know of today.
It does go in that direction. It's just there's such a long history of visitation, you might say, or extremely advanced cultures that had, they had their ships. They had, I know in the ancient Vedic scriptures, they talk about the Vimanas. And, you know, some were physical, some were more of an energy ship, and some were Merkabas, more of a spiritual vehicle. And they even described their weapons. And, you know, the great arrows, the fiery arrows that would seek out with sound or seek out with heat, you know. And pretty amazing recollections of something, you know. I don't know. You know, you're telling, you know, people go, all those are made up stories and things like that. Well, you know, first of all, you have to have the idea came from somewhere. And I don't see how you'd make up a story like that. You know, that, you know, if you, to make up a story, you have to have some reference points.
Yeah. And if it was just from one geological or geographical location, that would make sense as a made up story. But what we're seeing again is similarities. Dvarka being the legendary city of Krishna, a Hindu god, you bring up a good point there, James. What we see in the Mahabharata are tales of, you know, interaction with man and what appear to be gods that go back thousands of years. There's literally a date in the Mahabharata that we think is around 3000 BC for an actual aerial battle described in the Mahabharata, just like you said, where They seem to be shooting each other with, like, lasers and missiles. These are Hindu gods we're talking about, like Lord Krishna and various others, good and bad. What's really interesting, James, is, you know, through the documentary Dvarka, one of the researchers that Amish interviews has been doing astronomical reference points to say that in the Mahabharata, when they talk about this aerial battle, one of the battles with Krishna, he's literally able to date it, again, using astronomical references, what constellations are in the sky at the time of this battle. And he's come up with a date that's around just a little bit, before 3000 BC. Actually, excuse me, it's like
a little after 3000 BC. I think it's like 3063, BC, something like that. I have to get back to you on that exact number. Point is, in that same time frame of 3000 BC, where the Mahabharata is talking about ancient Vedic gods having battles, well, on the other side of the continent, or in another location on Earth, we have the Sumerian descriptions in ancient Iraq that have been uncovered. And in that same time frame of around 3000 BC are the mention of these beings, the Anunnaki, and literally very similar descriptions of battles taking place between these gods, the Anunnaki, and the human beings on Earth witnessing this and trying to figure it out. So there is some correlation, James, with beings that had the power of flight in 3000 BC having India's ancient texts talk about it, having Iraq's ancient texts talk about it, and wouldn't you know it, even in Egypt, which around 2500 BC, same kind of era, there are these descriptions of various gods from Isis and various Egyptian gods that interacted with man or were followed very closely by man. Mm-hmm. So I personally, yeah. James, have moved away from everything being alien, or saying that, let's say aliens were the helping hand or helped, influence our cultures. Not to say that they didn't, but I'm in my most recent years, and I'll discuss why, and leaning more towards the idea that there is this lost technological civilization that influenced all the ancient cultures that we know of today.
Yeah, my theory is that we are the aliens, that it's not the little bug-eyed, black-eyed, guys and things like that. Sure. Is that these beings, the Anunnaki, whoever you want to call them, it says those who came from heaven to earth, and they seem to have space-faring technologies, well written about in ancient times. And even the, if you look in the Native American prophecies and things and their traditions, they all point, most of them point to the Pleiades as their origin, and that's where they came from. And I know the Pleiades is really just a stopover for the ancient Lyrians, which from my understanding were the Anunnaki. They actually originated in ancient Lyra, and then they had homeworlds. They had a lot of different homeworlds. One of them, could be Planet X, who knows, or Nibiru.
Right. Well, yeah, and that's a very interesting topic to explore, and it's hard to come up with factual data sometimes about these more esoteric areas of extraterrestrial origins and such. And so I definitely, on a personal level, am very interested in these types of topics. But what I found, James, is that there seems to be another piece of information that is a scientific, an academic channel that can be further explored. It's so new to us that literally mainstream science is still very challenged by it, but it stacks up from an academic level. And that's simply, some of the terms to describe this we've heard over and over, but I don't think the general public gets it yet.
Mm-hmm.
When we hear things like the Dark Ages, or the Golden Age, right now, we have a very large cycle of time that we're just starting to understand and comprehend called the precession of the equinox. And this is basically the division of our heavens into 12 constellations. It's kind of like a grand celestial clock. Even Plato referred to this as the great year. So what's really interesting to me, James, is that there are over 30 ancient cultures that were aware of this larger cycle of time. Like the Mayans got all, famous because of their calendar being so accurate. Well, over 30 ancient cultures seem to have this lost astronomical knowledge of a larger cycle of time. And to put it into perspective, there are three cycles that we're talking about here. The first two we're aware of. This third cycle, the precession of the equinox, is a little bit more tricky, and I definitely would like to touch on it in our interview today. So these three cycles, again, all the ancients, over 30 of them, were aware of and said that they affected our life. Cycle number one is a very simple astronomical effect. It's the Earth spinning on its axis. Just because of the Earth spinning on its axis, we have day and night, 12 hours a day, 12 hours a night. We might not realize it, but as it gets dark, we fall asleep. Our subconscious kicks in. Our consciousness turns off. I mean, literally, that's an astronomical effect on us just by us spinning on the axis day and night. Cycle two, we're going around the sun. Every time we orbit the sun, seasons change, temperatures change, animals migrate, right? So there are physical effects from that second cycle, us going around the sun. The kicker, James, there's a third cycle. All the ancients said that this cycle lasts 24,000 years and does have an effect on us. So that's right now what we call the precession of the equinoxes. We go through a cycle every 2,000 years where the constellation that our North Star is pointing to changes its reference. So every 2,000 years or so. Right now, we're in the age of Pisces, which is that little symbol of a fish that you see a lot of Christian people put on the back of their car to symbolize Jesus. But actually is a much older symbolic reference to the age of Pisces, an astronomical reference. So, whew, I know that was a lot of info there. Basically, James, what I'm looking into is the fact that most of these megalithic sites, pyramids and various locations, have positioned themselves to astronomical points in space to mark where they were in this 24,000-year cycle. So there seems to be some very advanced piece of information where the ancients were aware of a cycle of time and watched it very carefully, knowing that it affects humanity's rise and fall of civilization here on Earth. And they encoded this into various megalithic monuments around the Earth.
And that would explain the Sphinx. In the I guess that was built in the constellation of Leo.
Right. Well, what's happening with Giza there is, you know, it's a perfect example. Is you can use star charting software, Redshift, various other free programs you can run like on an iPad, and it will tell you where the stars are going to be above you tonight, tomorrow night, a week from today, or 10,000 years ago. And so when you run this program, Giza, as an example, shows that the Orion constellation, three stars, the belt stars of Orion, one slightly offset, the three belt stars form a perfect terrestrial map of Giza, the three pyramids on the ground in Giza, in the year 10,500 BC. At that same time, the Sphinx is looking east directly into the constellation of Leo. So for some reason, at 10,500 BC, Giza is a terrestrial map of the sky. Leo and the lion of the Sphinx are perfectly aligned, and the pyramids are perfectly aligned with Orion in the sky. How the heck did they do that, and why? So what we're starting to see, James, is that, yeah, a lot of these locations were more than likely encoded to say that we were aware of this cycle of time, and we were at our highest point, you know, when this alignment took place, or that alignment. And I say that because if the Giza pyramids were built by the Egyptians in 2500 BC, somehow they aligned it to the sky in 10,500 BC. Why would they do that unless it's a date of great significance, or they were actually around at that time?
I know they've done a lot of research on dating the pyramids, and they're finding out that they're much older than the Egyptians would like to let us believe. And, you know, I just can't buy that theory of a bunch of slaves with, you know, a chisel and a rock made all those giant stones and put them into place, you know, in a certain amount of time. None of that adds up whatsoever.
Yeah, it's got some challenges, and thankfully, outside of the astronomical references that we just talked about there, there's geological references to push that date way, way further back. If we look at the inner walls of the Sphinx, the inner walls of the Sphinx have been inundated with water, like massive flowing water has eroded the inner walls of the Sphinx. There hasn't been any great rain or floods on the Giza Plateau for 10,000 years. So again, mm-hmm. we have geological references to show that there's been extensive weathering that, you know, could have only have happened at least, again, 10,000 years ago.
Yeah, and also, you know, to attribute to an advanced culture, we still cannot build one of those projects today. We don't have the cranes, you know, that can pick up those stones or even, produce them and move them like they did. So it's still quite a challenge even with today's technology, which shows they had some pretty extreme technology to, you know, to build these artifacts the way they did.
Yeah, I get that question a lot where I tie it into what you just explained there. I get the question, what's the best piece of evidence from the show Ancient Aliens to prove that there's aliens? You know, what's the best smoking gun to say that aliens are real? And I say, well, I just don't have the answer to that. But what's the best piece of smoking gun evidence from our past that makes your eyebrows kind of raise? The term is called vitrification. And it applies to most of these megalithic sites like Giza, where we have huge megalithic stones that we don't even know how they were able to cut or transport. But then on top of that, some of these stones have been stitched together in such a way where there's no mortar. You can't slide a piece of paper between the two stones. The only way that they were able to do this, sites like Machu Picchu and Sacsayhuaman, Pumapunku, all over South America and Peru, there are these sites where the stones, huge stones, are so perfectly fit together. The only way they could have been doing this is through a term called vitrification. It simply means taking a stone like granite, diorite, some of the hardest stones on the surface of the planet, and melting them to a point where they're in a lava-like state. So if you mm-hmm. melt a stone until it's kind of lava-like, then it becomes kind of like putty, and you can cut it and twist it or shape it, stack the stones, and then they harden back into place. And mm-hmm. all over these sites, we see this evidence of a glassing effect. It's called vitrification. It just means when a stone has been heated up to a point of a lava-like state, and then you scrape a flat surface over it, it leaves this glassing effect on the edges of the stone, which are a clear indicator that it's been heated to a magma state. We don't have any idea how ancient man was able to heat these stones or create liquid metal to do some of these connecting of the stones.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure they can come up with something. it's amazing.
Well, you know, as an example, you know, if you look at the Sinai Peninsula, there's vitrification all over the sand. There's glassing effects all over the sand. And some of the ancient Sumerian texts talk about, again, these aerial battles of the Anunnaki, mm-hmm. literally using weapons that created huge fire and smoke in the sky, possibly nuclear weapons. If you show a geologist the Sinai Peninsula and you say, look at all this vitrification, all this glassing of the sand, how could this be? They say, well, there must be volcanoes in the region. You say, there are no volcanoes in the Sinai Peninsula. They just kind of shake their heads and they don't know what to say. So it is an interesting thing.
Okay. Yeah, there's legends about, you know, the great wars of Atlantis, you know, in Lemuria where they came and they just melted down one of the cities with these beam weapons. And then you go and you find this great layers of glass, you know, in the Gobi Desert and other places that you're talking about. And you go, well, how did that get here? I mean, some incredible force, you know, you know, turned this sand into glass. And I guess one of the things they keep saying is that, well, that's a meteor did that or whatever, but that's the only thing they can come up with.
Yeah, unfortunately, the meteor was able to strike Pumapunku and create an unbelievably articulate city. That would be, I think, even more of an anomalous way to explain.
Well, it broke up into perfect blocks, and then it all came back together as a wall.
I think there's definitely pieces all over the planet that to this lost understanding of technology that we just don't attribute to the ancient man of today. And partly, you know, again, James, I think that has to do with how we view history. And right now, everyone pretty much believes history to be linear, that something ever so simplistic will become something ever so complex. And I'm not sure that that's the case. It seems more likely that we are in a cyclical evolution pattern. We go through a rise and fall of civilizations here on Earth, as I mentioned earlier. Again, people have heard of things like the Dark Ages, the Golden Age. Well, there's new research to try and kind of explain why we have the precession of the equinox. Up until now, modern science has been trying to kind of relearn this information. And I say relearn it because we see evidence of this cycle where we go into the Dark Ages and forget things and then come out of the Dark Ages and relearn. And here's an example. If we look at what was happening in around 3000 BC, we see evidence of high civilization, high astronomy in Egypt, in Iraq, then called Sumer. We see massive evidence in the time frame of around 3000 BC for great understandings of astronomy and architecture. And then what happens? We go into the Dark Ages, right? And it becomes more like HBO's Game of Thrones. We forget everything and just become a very barbaric culture. And then we come out of the Dark Ages and we have Copernicus and Galileo starting to relearn this astronomical data. And now we're at where we are today with a firm understanding that we orbit the sun and that there's these astronomical cycles. But we didn't even know that a few thousand years ago in the Dark Ages. But if you go back further than that, we did know it. Somehow we forgot it. So the reason to explain this, I think, James, is that there's possibly another larger astronomical cycle that does affect us. And that might be that we have two suns. This is a new concept being explored to explain the precession of the equinox, which modern science currently says it's because of our moon creating a little wobble on our Earth. And it just doesn't hold up. A new model says the reason why we have this precession of the equinox, this large cycle of time that repeats, and this is heavy, is potentially because we have two suns, meaning our sun is in orbit around another sun. Now, most of the other solar systems we've been filming external to ours are binary. They have at least two suns, suns four or six, and they're in an intricate dance around each other. So it stands to reason our solar system is in fact binary, and our sun is traveling around our second sun. And if you think about that, if our sun is literally moving through space orbiting another sun, well, guess what? We're going along for the ride. Since we're orbiting the sun, we're moving along through space around it, around this other second sun. So I know this is a heavy thing to be saying in your interview today, James, but I guarantee you this is definitely the topic of interest for me, this lost cycle of time, and understanding that most of the ancient cultures, over 30 ancient cultures, were aware of this larger cycle and attributed a knowledge of two suns to this equation. So it's
now there's also, along with the second sun, there seems to be another mini solar system that comes with it. Is that correct?
Well, you know, again, this is a topic that I'm still looking into. But yes, there are several theories that, you know, we could have a second sun that, again, has its own system around it. We haven't identified what that second sun is or where it is. Some have postulated that Sirius A and B might be our second sun, and that there's a whole other civilization around Sirius A and B on one of their planets. It's a very interesting thing to look at, again, from an academic, scientific perspective, where we're crunching the numbers, looking at our astronomical data, and coming to the conclusion that, again, we might very well be binary. And if that's the case, it really does raise a whole new understanding to our cosmology.
Well, there's some event that seems to happen every so often, you know, that's in the period in geology that keeps talking about huge shifts and changes, you know, pole shifts and things of that nature. And, you know, it seems like when you really think about going into the Dark Ages, it wouldn't take that much to put us there, because if you shut the grid down, I know that once the grid goes down, all your computers, your laptops, your iPhones, everything are of no use. And you're back to basic survival on, you know, where are you going to get your food, where you're going to get your next meal is going to be coming from, and where you're going to get your heat and your structures. And, you know, not to put a doom and gloom story on it, but, you know, when the grid goes down, the water stops pumping, the gas stops pumping, you know, the sewers stop pumping. And it wouldn't be that far-fetched to think that, you know, just one good, you know, X-class flare hitting the sun would take care of that. A meteor coming in that would explode in the upper atmosphere would do that. There's a lot of different things that would do that. You know, pole shift would definitely do it, and there's a lot of historical records of that. So, you know, it makes sense that there has been some advanced cultures here that have come and gone over time, and we're not so impervious to moving into the same experience.
Yeah, unfortunately, there is always yin and yang to the story of humanity, and it appears that the idea of global cataclysms, you know, the last one, a great flood or something, that we can look in geological layers and see these layers of sediment that seem to have covered the planet at certain times. And I think there's possibly between 10 to 13,000 years ago evidence of some type of large catastrophic event. And that puts us right about when we were in the last golden age. It's about 10,000 years ago, because we're about 8 to 10,000 years now from being in the golden age. We're about 8,000 years away, and then, you know, it lasts for several thousand years.
Yeah.
So the point is, James, is that even when we're in the golden age, we're still susceptible to being whacked by an asteroid or a meteor. And that's possibly what could have happened in the last golden age, is even though we were technologically advanced, there seems to have been evidence for also a great global cataclysm as well.
Well, I know that when you read the stories of the city of Krishna, which is Dwarka?
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of the name. Yeah. When you read about that, they talk about these ancient cities of gold and silver and massive jewels, you know, in their buildings. And, you know, they were definitely living the good life. You know, they talk about just flowers everywhere, bees. It was like the land of milk and honey, basically. So, I mean, they were very advanced, and, you know, it talks about the wars that they had and their ships and everything else they flew on. So they were, you know, according to the tales, were extremely advanced civilization, and, you know, and they didn't do too well with whatever happened. You know, I think they either a massive flood or a pole shift or whatever, but now they're most of them are underneath the ocean.
Well, and that's why we're trying to, you know, look into some of these sites, James. And thankfully, you know, the partnership that I formed with Amit Shah, we're really using global resources to execute this. And some of these, again, require sponsorship or partners from mainstream science. I'll give you an example. NASA has some new technology called synthetic aperture radar, and they essentially loaded up this huge 747 a couple of years ago. With this synthetic aperture radar, and then they can fly it over locations where it does ground penetrating radar. So a couple of years ago, they flew this over Cambodia, and they found these pyramids that were covered by jungle and partially underground. But the synthetic aperture radar was able to see that and see the layers of how deep it went. So there are definitely tools available to us, whether it be from academic or, you know, privately financed, that we can go to these locations and utilize the technology that we have today and get a view of these and formulate an opinion that might not be perfectly in alignment with the university in that geographical area.
Yeah.
But from a global perspective, we're definitely seeing lost cities. And some of them, as you mentioned, are still underwater.
Yeah, they've got I think it's Yonaguni off the coast of Japan, and they've got off the coast of Cuba, they've got a major city there. They're saying that's 5,000 to 7,000 feet underneath the ocean in some part. And I'm just blown away by that. You know,
that's deep.
You can imagine a landmass that was once above water is now that deep. You know, that's a major change, a major earth change. And they've got one off of Guam, and they're finding these sunken cities everywhere, it seems like.
Right, and that's partly where I'm interested in piecing together this, the evidence of this lost culture that seemed to affect all the high ancients we know of today, Mayans, Egyptians, Toltecs, Sumerians. All of those ancient cultures have evidence of high astronomy and are utilizing monuments and structures before their time. Someone else built them. Now we say they were built by the gods. But
yeah.
A lot of these locations depict this type of being that I'm not sure if it's 100% human or not, but it's this long, slender being. Easter Island is a good example. Everyone has seen these large Moai heads, but they're not just heads, right? They started to dig around the head and excavated what appears to be a full-length body, meaning the head is buried. The whole body has been buried, and just the head sticking up. Those Moai heads on Easter Island are all long, slender beings with the hands wrapped at the waist. And that's exactly what we're seeing in other locations, like Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, which is possibly 13,000 years old or maybe even older. On the pillars, we again see these slender beings with their hands wrapped at the waist. And I've seen these depicted at other sites, Bata Valley in Indonesia, Sumerian figurines. They seem to be depicting this same being that might be some lost influencer for all the ancient cultures.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it seems like, too, the giants, you know, there's tales of these, you know, you look ancient history, they all seem to be very tall, you know, very, the rulers of ancient times, you know, they all were very tall. And if you look at some of these ancient temples and the chairs that they sit in the doorways, you go, whoa, whose place was this built for? You know, because that would, a regular guy sitting in that chair would look like, you know, look like a little monkey almost. And you know, it's like, why would they do that? Why would they build such a large chair, you know, and have such huge doors if the people weren't, you know, very tall beings?
Yeah, that's a good question, James, and I know it's been controversial because of the hoaxes where people try to Photoshop things being found that are skeletons. I'm sure they have found some large remnants, skulls and bones, but that's a very hard thing to answer, and I hear what you're saying. Many of the depictions of these Anunnaki, they're always much larger in stature and in size than the normal Sumerians.
Yeah. And they all have the, you know, they have the bearded god, you know, they have the, either the green-eyed or blue-eyed bearded god, you know, in all the cultures, you know, when they talk about the image of God that we have, it always seems to be this bearded, you know, very tall bearded god, you know, so I do believe
point.
That there is a source beyond that, but, you know, I think I always go, who created them and did they have a mother? You know, I always ask those questions.
Yeah, a lot of the South American cultures always pique my interest in that their gods, Quetzalcoatl or Kukulcan, they're always depicted. You know, you think your South American people are dark-skinned, dark-haired people, but their gods, Quetzalcoatl, Kukulcan, they're always depicted as either like blonde hair or red hair, tall, pale skin. That doesn't sound like an indigenous god. It's not of their culture.
Yeah.
So it is interesting that, you know, it's not like a god from Anglo-Saxon Europe. All around the world, there are these similar depictions of beings, even from cultures that don't have a genetic tie to the god, are depicting the same being.
Mm-hmm. I know a lot of times we have to operate within, you know, the mainstream constructs and things like that to get things forward, but I've never been one for that. I've always gone way outside the box. But it's kind of my theory that the Earth has been colonized many times over and over again. And and we're just a big genetic soup down here. You know, and the story of Anunnaki, I think that's correct. You know, that they did come here and they found a knuckle dragger, you know, a Neanderthal man, and added their genetics to it to bump them up. But at the same time, you know, when I look at all this stuff, I go, well, you know, there's also other stories as well, and even more ancient stories. And, you know, it just goes on and on about all these different events that have happened here again and again, you know, that I just don't think it's one thing. We can't pigeonhole it into one story. There's many, many stories in the very, very long history of the Earth with different advanced civilizations, and some of them coming and going.
Yeah, and maybe a history that goes beyond Earth. I mean, my original interest into these topics, I'm 40 now, and when I was 20 in college, someone had mentioned to me that there was a face and pyramid that NASA had taken photos of on the surface of Mars in a region called Cydonia. And I was very skeptical to this information, had no interest in UFOs or history of any kind. But when I started to look into these structures on Mars, I found out that there was pretty much 90% of the images that we've been taking of the surface of Mars come from one company, which was also located in San Diego where I was attending college, called Malin Space Science Systems. And so I contacted Dr. Mike Malin, very interested in the state pyramids possibly on the surface of Mars, and just as a layman, asked Dr. Mike Malin, hey, is there any possibility that the face and pyramids are artificial? And he said, no, these are all sand and wind eroded structures, no evidence of artificiality. That made my eyebrows raise a little bit, because I was able to find 5 to 10 peer-level review scientists. They didn't work at NASA, but they had PhD credentials in satellite imagery analysis. One of these guys, a Dr. Mark Carlotto, you know, when we talk about mainstream science, sometimes making the connections for mainstream science or connecting various departments, Dr. Mark Carlotto is a scientist that develops fractal algorithms that he runs over satellite images to detect artificial structures. As an example, when he ran his fractal algorithms over Russian satellite data, he was able to determine, oh, those are troops or a tank covered by some bushes or a tarp. When he ran his fractal analysis over the telemetry of Mars and the face and pyramid, the face and pyramids come out to be a 98% probability to be artificial. Now, NASA never did any type of public analysis at that level of scrutiny. They just said, there's nothing to see here, move on. So I agree with you that mainstream science kind of turns an eye to these topics. But there is enough of science available to us where we can apply from one field to another and sometimes extrapolate information where very quickly mainstream science finds their foot in their mouth.
And what's amazing, too, is that they will not let go. And I know they said, you know, the real science will come out when the old scientists die, basically, because they've all written books and they're telling people how it is and they're teaching it in the schools. But, you know, we're finding out over and over again is those books are wrong. And there's a mountain of evidence showing that they are incorrect. But until these guys, you know, cross over or whatever, or disappear or drop their egos, you know, we're going to be stuck with the same old story.
That's a good way to put it. And that's why it's so fun to look at the past, James, in my opinion, is, you know, like the Mahabharata and some of these ancient Vedic texts go back 10,000 years. And literally some of the information, I mean, they talk about the same thing that we've talked about today, these advanced cycles of time where we go into a golden age and a dark age. The ancient Vedic texts describe these as the cycle of the yugas, which essentially is the same exact description used from other cultures. Again, an understanding of a breakdown of the heavens into 12 zodiacal symbols and using it as a grand celestial clock, a 24,000-year cycle. It's very interesting that so many ancient cultures use this as a reference point. And we can now look back at these ancient cultures and use our understanding of science today to start to pull out these pieces of information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Ignore that beep. That's my phone doing its thing. I was going to tell the audience here, just it's kind of funny, but just getting you on to bring this information out, you know, was quite a monumental event because they shut down 2 or 3 forms of communication we had going on. And so we're doing this from a cell phone, which I think is interesting, but obviously, there are elements out there that would definitely not want people to hear this information because it does kind of fly in the face of the old curriculum and the old belief structures. But
sure.
But anyway, you know, I'm just seeing over and over, I think, as we expand our ability to see, you know, to see out in the stars, I mean, now they're up to, I don't know how many million, planets they've found out there that can sustain life where they, before they said there weren't any, you know, there was that we were it. And, so now with the new technology, they find out that there's billions, millions, probably billions of planets out there that can sustain life. And, you know, it's just going to keep expanding. And, you know, I think when we're ready as a civilization, these beings are going to, you know, make contact and they are going to choose certain people, you know, that have risen to the occasion, you know, to work through. And that's just a no-brainer because, I don't know, if you drop in on Billy Bob on the ranch, you know, he's probably going to get his shotgun and come after you, you know, so. So you'd want to come after somebody that had some kind of reference point, that did their homework, you know, that understood, that were ready, that weren't going to greet you in fear or aggression.
All throughout history, there's been this interaction with the spiritual being, whether they be aliens or spirits, like in the Bible. It's always through some communication that, you know, like, you know, somebody receives a ring in a dream, then they wake up and they see that the ring is real. Ancient biblical mm-hmm. figures and things have always been given information through a loosely translated way of communication, whether it be in the dream state or some abduction experience. Throughout time, there are these interactions. But what I think is interesting, James, is why are the aliens not here now? Why don't we see open communication like we've seen in the past? In my opinion, it speaks to this larger mm-hmm. cycle of time. If we see what we're doing now, blowing up the planet, killing each other, more technology, more advanced interaction might hurt us. We might, you know, make worse decisions. It seems to me that if we are in a cycle of golden age, dark age, golden age, dark age, when we're in the golden ages, it's very easy to see that we'd be interacting with other higher forms of life, whether they be spiritual beings, dimensional beings, aliens, it's probably all mixed. But then, when we go into the dark ages and we forget all this interaction, I think these advanced beings probably look at us and say, well, we need to give them a little bit more time in their evolutionary process. But it doesn't seem like that hasn't happened in the past. It seems like it's happened over and over, and possibly they're just waiting for us again to reach that state where it is actually beneficial for them to interact with us directly.
Exactly. We need to rise to the occasion because there's no sense in working with us, you know, if we're aggressive, you know, and destructive and bent on destroying our own planet and each other, which it seems to be where we're going with the netting, especially with our leadership of today.
But outside that mainstream contact, I agree with you that anyone who pays attention to the field of ufology will see that just within the own time frame of our civilization, the last 100 years or so, there's always been a subtle line of communication to these outside beings, not human beings, that is only for a select few.
Yeah.
It makes it difficult for the mass to fully understand those interactions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have that going on here. We've had NASA out here, everybody, and Triple PhD Boeing engineers and Lockheed Skunk Works people, and just about everybody's come out here and have seen the ships and watched them interact with us, and they come right on schedule exactly when we say they will and where, with the cameras rolling. You know, we did it with Robbie Williams and Danny Dyer and ABC special out here too as well. So it's kind of interesting that, you know, we know exactly when and where the ships are going to appear. They do. They fly at treetop level mm-hmm. and do some nice turns and things. But, still that's not good enough for, most of mainstream. So we just kind of said, well, if you're really interested, you want to do your own research, come out and check it out. But, you know, we're not here to try to push anything or force anything on anybody. But, you know, the evidence is here and it's ongoing. It hasn't stopped. And we always tell people to come out and bring your cameras.
Right. Well, I definitely think it's a personal thing for people to explore these topics. And yes, hopefully within our lifetime, we can have more of a ubiquitous approach to agreement, where right now it's like somebody has a sighting and this person has a sighting, but it'd be nice to have things happen at a civilization level where you know, it wouldn't be able to be denied.
Yeah.
With our graphics and CGI today, it's so difficult to take any type of substantial evidence in video format or what have you and convince people of, hopefully, a precipice that we're going to cross over soon into just meeting the people.
Yeah. Well, we've had, what's interesting here is I've had that experience, but I can't really go forward with that one right now just because of the conditions. But, you know, we paid heavily for doing the work that we're doing, and we've been hit by everything you can imagine. We have black helicopters buzzing us on a regular basis and playing with their toys, you know, as well as other things. But there's a major effort to close this down and not let this information out, just like, you know, the archaeological ruins that they're starting to uncover that are going against status quo. It seems like that element that's suppressing this and holding this back has to get, you know, under control or get phased out somehow, and then all this stuff is just going to blossom like crazy.
Hopefully within our lifetime, James. I would really like to see that take place.
Yeah, I think, you know, my feeling is it's going to happen very soon. I really do, because I think this whole planet is not ready for a revolution. They're just tired of the tyranny and tired of the suppression and tired of the withholding of information. And, you know, we have all the tools we need to transcend disease and all the free energy technology, everything we need to turn this planet around. The only thing we don't have is the leadership, you know, to make it happen. So as soon as we can get that thing straightened out, I think we're going to have a huge, new renaissance, you know, with all these new technologies and you know, basically we need to identify what is creating all the disease and sickness on the planet and stop those guys as well. You know, so it's, you know, it seems to be happening, but anyway, we're running out of the end of time. What's the best way for people to contact you to get, any information concerning your endeavors there?
I definitely recommend people check out ancientexplorers.com. We're going to be doing the release of the Dwarka documentary on May 1st as a 24-hour free screening. And then beyond that, we're going to be launching a community where people can join in our adventures and either come along with us or follow along through our member community as we explore these various locations.
Great. And so to get in contact, is the best way to go through the website?
Yeah, just go to ancientexplorers.com. And you can find out more about what we're doing.
Great. Hey, well, keep up the great work. And I think it's so important that, you know, you do a grassroots situation like this and start educating the people, because that's the only way, you know, these things are going to come forward. When you educate enough people, it becomes, you know, more of a fact and more of a reality, and more people are interested in opening up to these new ideas. And they're not really new, actually, the ancient ideas that are circling.
Yeah, it's an interesting time, James, and I have my fingers crossed that things will continue to get more and more positive.
Yeah. Well, we've hit the end of the hour. I can't thank you enough for coming on the show, and I know we've got a lot more information we can cover, but we'll have to get you back on again.
For sure. Thank you so much for having me on, James. Talk to you soon.
All right. Have a great day. Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, this is James Gillen, your host, signing off. Have a great day and watch the skies and do your own research as far as the ancient history and the ancient origin of man. Have a good day.